Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Delaware's Prescription Opioid Settlement Distribution Commission recently resumed handing out grants under new leadership.
We approved approximately $13 million for the general grants, but there was over $47 million worth of asks.
We check in with the commission's new executive director, Brad Owens, about the direction the group is headed. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. In Arts Playlist, we hear how a local composer is helping bring attention to stories connected to Delaware's lone Revolutionary War battlefield. And we bring you the latest episode of the Delaware Humanities People and Planet podcast. It's all next on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Delaware's Prescription Opioid Settlement Distribution Commission has undergone a mass restructuring over the past year. The commission is in charge of distributing the funds awarded to the first state through legal challenges against opioid manufacturers and distributors. After one grant recipient was flagged for potential misuse of funds last year, the commission has completely overhauled its grant program and welcomed a new executive director, Brad Owens. Delaware Public Media's Sarah Petrowich recently spoke with Owens about the new and improved Opioid Commission, the latest $13 million grant cycle, and where he plans to take the commission moving forward.
Okay, so for starters, Brad, can you introduce yourself a little bit, talk about your new role within the commission, sort of how that position came to be, you know, where your background was, and how you became involved in the Prescription Opioid Settlement Distribution Commission?
Sure. My name is Brad Owens. I'm the new director of the Prescription Opioid Settlement Distribution Commission. It's a mouthful. Trying to explain to my mom what my position is hard. So I just say the Opioid Commission. I was appointed by the DHSS secretary in May full-time, but I started in March as the part-time interim director for the commission with the goal of launching round three of our grant-making program. I'm not new to the commission entirely. In fact, I started with the commission as a contractor, a part-time grant monitor, 5 to 10 hours a week in previous years. So I have some sort of background knowledge of the commission and understanding of its foundation and the legal history of everything. In addition to serving as a contractor, I've spent the last 15 years of my life as a correctional health care provider, particularly in reentry services, substance abuse and mental health services. That's where my area of expertise is in. I'm also a trained attorney. I don't currently practice law, but having gone through law school and specializing in nonprofit law and criminal justice, so it gives me the background and experience to take on a role like this.
So not only did you step into this new role, but the commission has undergone a lot of changes as well. You know, it shifted from the lieutenant governor's office. There were also a lot of recommendations by outside contractor social contract to sort of bolster the grant cycle, how funds could be applied for, distributed, all of that. So there was obviously a lot of changes that happened. But can you give us a rundown of sort of the major differences between what was going on then versus now and how you think that those will be more successful in helping to get funds out to the people that need them the most?
Yeah, major changes. We sort of revamped our grant making program based on the recommendations provided by a social contract and our governance committee. And when I took over this role, I essentially took that playbook that social contract created and launched a new program that included three different grant types, which is new. We have micro grants, mini grants, and general grants. Each have a different, you know, tier of funding, which is meant to diversify funding, enable grassroots organizations to apply who might not have the capacity to manage large sums of monies, but want to provide a service and with a little technical assistance from us can do that. So that's where the micro grants and mini grants come in. And then the general grants are intended to be for organizations that have a demonstrable history. Can demonstrate that to us with annual reports and other documents. So the structure of our grant-making program has significantly changed this year.
For this third phase, it looks like around $14 million was approved in grant funding, going out to a lot of different organizations for a lot of different projects. Can you talk a little bit about the timeline for distributing those grants, and how that process sort of came to be and what you're looking forward to moving forward with the $14 million?
We took very serious the review process for those grant applications. Another major change, as opposed to previous years, was having a robust application review team. So we had 10 people on the review team that reviewed every grant and grant application. Each grant application was reviewed multiple times, and it was really hard to come up with a list of grantees. We had 122 grantees. I'm sorry, we had 122 applicants, right? With 63 recommended grantees. Only 30 of them were general grants, meaning those larger grants. So, we approved approximately 13 million for the general grants, but there was over $47 million worth of asks. So, it was a difficult job selecting those applicants and future grantees. But what's next? My next priority is developing scopes of work and contracts for those 63 grantees between now and September. That's a collaborative process between us and the grantees, where we revisit their application. We develop a scope of work together. Some of these budgets were much bigger. The proposed budgets were much bigger than what we had money for. So if somebody proposed to do services A, B, and C for $1 million and they were only awarded a half $1 million, we kind of have to go back and determine which parts of that application we're going to keep and which ones we're going to put into the scope of work. So that's what we're doing now, between now and September. Ideally, monies are distributed in September. That's my personal goal. It's not, prescribed to me by the commission or anything. It's just a goal I've set for myself.
Got it. And I think one of the hot topics around this commission and getting funding to the right places has been more for long-term care options, for people with addiction, more inpatient treatment, getting some treatment facilities up, which obviously are a lot more expensive, and require a lot more intensive labor. But is that something that the commission is looking into? Are there any updates on projects related to that type of care?
Yes, actually. As you might know, there's been a call to action, if you will, for the commission to fund or at least consider funding long-term care treatment options. And there may be a need for long-term care options here in Delaware, but we, as the commission, want to make informed decisions as to how we spend the money and what exactly Delaware needs. Long-term care means lots of things. It doesn't just mean a long-term stint in an inpatient recovery treatment center, right? It also means a continuum of care for folks long-term beyond that inpatient treatment stay. So we want to ensure that individuals who are in recovery have long-term care options and can continue receiving services down that line that go beyond just inpatient treatment. Inpatient treatment, certainly a need, but also comes with other considerations, including expenses. And we want to, even if that is the best way to spend our money, we want to ensure that there's sustainability there, and that there are other stakeholders at the table, Medicaid, for example, insurance providers, the state. We need to assess all of that. So what we're doing as the commission is hiring a consultant, a subject matter expert, to assess the need for long-term care options here in Delaware, and to highlight or make recommendations for the role of the Opioid Commission.
You also mentioned Medicaid there, and as with it seems like every story these days, some component ties to the big, beautiful bill that was just passed, some federal cuts that are coming down the pike. What have those discussions been like so far as how this money gets doled out? Does there need to be any extra considerations, as far as thinking about these cuts to Medicaid that are coming in the out years?
Yeah, I think it would be irresponsible for us not to consider those cuts and what kind of impact they're going to have on Delaware. If the federal government is cutting funding, whether it be Medicaid or other funds for drug programming here in Delaware, then we need to ensure that, one, we have enough funds with the Opioid Commission that can maybe fill gaps if there are gaps. So that's one. And two, we did see an increased number of applicants who we haven't seen in previous years. And I think part of that is because they either have received cuts to their funding from the federal government or anticipate having cuts to their funding from the federal government. So we see a lot of new organizations applying for opioid dollars who normally wouldn't have applied for opioid settlement dollars. And a lot of the cited reasons are because of fear of funding cuts or literal funding cuts that have already happened. So it's definitely an issue we're paying attention to. And the advantage of the Opioid Commission, or one advantage at least of the commission being underneath of DSAM, is that we have a DSAM has a robust sort of network, knowledge base, and resources. They have teams of people who are paying attention to federal funds and are able to we're able to apply that knowledge to the Opioid Commission as well, and sort of work in tandem, DSAM and Opioid Commission. So that is a huge advantage, I think, post change from the Lieutenant Governor's office to DSAM. The commission now has sort of a robust network and information system because of DSAM. So, and we're going to use all that as best as we can to sort of be informed about what's coming and what our grantees need to fill the gaps and the needs of the people.
Yeah. And I think I just want to get your final thoughts on the direction of the commission and these grants moving forward. It looks like opioid deaths are on the decline in Delaware, which is great, but the actual number of overdoses are still cause for concern within the state, and those numbers are always fluctuating. But with that in mind, as well as sort of the potential fraudulent use that sort of spurred all these changes within the commission to where we are now, how do you feel moving forward about getting these grants to the right people and, helping to tackle this crisis as a whole within the first state?
Yeah, I think a part of that is how we're measuring outcomes and outputs. One of my goals and priorities right now is improving our grants management system, our data collection systems, to be able to analyze data in real time and to use data to make informed decisions about how we spend money going forward. That's not something the commission has done the best of jobs with in previous years. We haven't quite looked back to see what's working. And what's not. And I do believe there is a correlation between the opioid settlement dollars and a reduction in overdoses, but we need to be able to identify that correlation a little bit better. And I think the way to do that is through a better data collection system. So we are right now talking to Salesforce and Tableau, one of their other products, to have a much more robust data management system that can help inform us going forward, and look back at grantees who have been awarded and assess how well they're doing. Is it working? Is it not working? What else do you need? Or are there other organizations that can do a better job? So that's part of the big shift here, and a part of my focus is to improve that grant management process, which I think will also help weed out those organizations that don't have either the best interest in mind or don't have the capacity to do what they say they're going to do. But we need to measure that a little bit better, and that's what I'm looking forward to.
Thanks to the Delaware Prescription Opioid Settlement Distribution Commission's new Executive Director, Brad Owens, and our Sarah Petrowich for joining us on The Green this week. And stay with us, Art's Playlist is next, where we learn how a local composer is using his skills to put the spotlight on stories connected to Delaware's lone Revolutionary War battlefield. That's next on The Green, here on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Cooch's Bridge Historic Site near Newark is one of the state's most storied historic locations, known for being the site of the only Revolutionary War battle in the first state. It was also home to generations of African Americans, both free and enslaved. In 2023, composer and percussionist Jonathan Whitney, himself a Newark native, was commissioned by the Friends of Cooch's Bridge Historic Site to tell those stories in music, in a work called Cooch's Bridge, The African American Presence. In this edition of Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny is joined by Whitney to discuss his music.
Well, let me start by just asking about about you and about your background and how you got to sort of this point in your artistic journey?
It's interesting. Everybody has their earliest childhood memory. And my earliest childhood memory is at the drums, this gold drum set that my dad's brother had just returned to him. So, you know, I've been fascinated with music for a long time. We always had an organ in the house, and I would spend hours at the organ just making up songs on it. You know, so that was the beginning of this composition journey and the drumming journey. But then you fast forward to, you know, time in Glasgow High School, playing in the marching band, and time at Christina Cultural Arts Center playing piano, you know, laying that foundation. I went to University of Delaware. I got in as a chemistry major and then realized that I was practicing 3 hours a day. I probably should be a music major. And then from there, you know, things just began to grow. You know, I had a love for percussion, a love for writing. It started out writing for drum lines and marching bands. And then it moved into, after grad school, writing for jazz bands. And actually that began to grow while I was at Tatnall as a band director, you know, writing for the band there. And then after I realized that that's something you can do, you know, I really began to focus on it.
I'd like to kind of focus on your work, Cooch's Bridge, the African-American presence. And I wonder if you could start by just telling me about the music. What does it sound like? What kind of inspiration did you bring into composing it?
Yeah, Cooch's Bridge, the African-American presence, the sound of it, really, when I began doing the research and I thought about the people we were talking about, I said, you know what, a jazz suite is what this needs to be. The jazz band, you know, the classical music that African-Americans gave to America, that brought, you know, created in America. And so really, it lives all across that broad form called jazz. We start out on playing djembe, like the roots in Africa, when we talk about our ancestors. But then you get into Afro-Cuban music. We get into hard bop, so some serious, you know, bebop and hard bop. But there's also some funk.
We're free. We're heading all that, yeah. We're free.
And at the end, it's really a more contemporary feel, you know, as we just bring all these voices into play. So, but it lives in that jazz world of improvisation and speaking in the moment and responding to each other and conveying the emotions that are written into a piece.
It felt to me like it's kind of one of those pieces that lives in that liminal space between classical and jazz. Like I'm thinking about some of the ballet stuff that Duke Ellington wrote or some of the music that Wynton Marsalis has written. It sort of lives in that middle space.
Yeah, and I'm really inspired by those guys. There's a suite that, or oratorio that Wynton Marsalis wrote called Blood on the Fields. It's a 3-hour oratorio, won a Pulitzer. I listened to that hundreds of times during when I was in college. Just, I was so inspired by that work and the way he gave voice to all those different stories. You know, and how the music really brought the energy and the power that was already inside the story and brought it up. So, you know, so yet I can't deny it. Duke Ellington is at the core of all of us. And Wynton was really one of my gateways into this type of writing.
You mentioned this a moment ago, and I know you do a lot of research. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the research that you did for Cooch's Bridge, the African-American presence.
Yeah. So there's several different layers of research that I did there. I had amazing access from the Cooch family, Dick Cooch, and the family who gave me access to their archives. You know, and their lead archivist is Wade Katz. So I had access to Wade and another historian, Caitlin Dyke, and I sat down with them first. And they sort of laid out the broad picture, but also said, hey, these are things that we haven't gotten to check into yet. Just, you know, if you wanted to do this or look at this. I also contacted Winitor and I became a fellow there, a research fellow there, where I was able to use their library. They have a vast amount of information there about Newcastle County, objects, history, maps, you know, so I really was able to get the context from there. I used research databases that you can find online. Like there was a database of all the apprentice indentures in Delaware. And so I was able to look them up and see if we had any at Cooch's Bridge, and we found some. And then there were conversations with descendants of people who worked or were enslaved at Cooch's Bridge. You know, I got to speak to them and hear about what their family's take on the Cooch's, on that time at Cooch's Bridge were, and what their connection with Cooch's Bridge was, and where their families are now, you know, and the great things that are happening now, and how all that's a legacy that stems back to there. You know, the James family worked for the Cooch's for many generations, not just one or two, you know, and that family is still, you know, a family of pride-filled, hard-working African-Americans. You know, so it was great to get to talk to them, and we wrote pieces about them too.
Your piece is 11 movements, and I wonder, is there one particular story that you're telling, one particular person's life that you're putting into this music that really resonates with you?
You know, the one that resonates with me the most is Jesse. I really love Jesse's story. We don't know a ton about Jesse, but what we do know is Jesse was enslaved by the Cooch's. He ran away twice. After he was caught the second time, he negotiated his own freedom. You know, so just thinking about like the fire inside of that belly to say, I know you caught me twice, but now we're going to figure out a way for me to be free. And that, you know, so to read his story was just so inspiring. And, you know, the lens I try to show these black bodies through isn't through their trauma, but through their humanity, who they were as people, you know? And, you know, we talk about a lot of the people that everybody I talk to, I talk about through that lens. You know, what was her smile like? The things that we can't that aren't documented, not that we couldn't, but aren't documented about black people in history. So for Jesse, you know, yes, he was enslaved. But man, the man ran away twice. And then he got back and said, look, what are we going to do about this? You know, so he's an inspired. He's one of my, you know, all the stories really inspired me. I actually had to cut off research and stop writing. I called Vince and I said, hey, I'm at an hour, but I have like three more movements. He says, I think an hour's enough. But I'm sure there'll be a second suite that comes out with some of these other stories.
Where can people hear some of this music?
So we actually just, tomorrow I'm going to the studio. We've finished recording it on May. We're currently in the mixing process, and it should be released in the fall sometime.
Great.
So right now, you know, there's little snippets on YouTube, if you look up Cooch's Bridge, the African American Presence. But we'll be doing an album release soon, and that'll be really magical. The album really captures the essence of each of these individuals and these stories.
And then finally, what do you hope people who hear this music will take away with them after they've heard it?
I hope that they'll look at history through a different lens. You know, we have all the facts that we look at, but sometimes we forget that, you know, these families that we talk about also put their kids to bed. They had kids that ran into the house muddy. You know, we forget that, you know, some of these bodies that we talk about, the trauma that was inflicted on them, also danced and laughed and joked, you know? And so I want people to ask those questions that can't be answered about these individuals, these bodies that we research, you know? Man, imagine what could they have been like? Even though we don't know exactly, we don't have video from back then. You know, we know the Cooch slaves all got together on Saturday and danced. Was Samuel one of the ones that sat there and laughed and just sort of sat with his friends, or was he up dancing? You know, those are the questions I want people to ask.
Thanks to Delaware-born composer and percussionist Jonathan Whitney, the composer of Cooch's Bridge, the African-American Presence, and our Martin Matheny for joining us on Arts Playlist. You can learn more about Jonathan Whitney and his music at jwwmusic.com. And we wrap up The Green next with the latest episode of the Delaware Humanities podcast, People and Planet. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. This week, we bring you the latest episode of the Delaware Humanities podcast, People and Planet. The podcast explores how Delawareans connect to the environments and cultures around them, and the cultural practices and creative works that bring us closer to the planet we call home. On this episode, the podcast focuses on a pair of first date destinations that connect people to their planet by educating them about the world around them. The Delaware Museum of Nature and Science and the Brandywine Zoo each offer windows into habitats in our own backyards and around the world, and how we engage with them in a meaningful and positive way. To explain how they do that, the podcast welcomes Mandy Santiago, Executive Director of the Delaware Museum of Nature and Science, and Brent Spencer, Brandywine Zoo Director. So let's start with, when you guys are thinking about your mission through the lens of connecting people to habitats and the environment around them, what are your top priorities? Are there a North Star or two that guide you and your teams as you try to connect people with the world around them? And Brent, we'll start with you.
Sure. One of the things that we look at is, are there actions that our visitors can take that can help the animals that they're getting interested in? And probably a good example of that is our Madagascar exhibit. We have graphics up there talking about conservation messages. But we also put some things into the exhibit that will hopefully help reinforce that. So we have some artificial stones in the mud bank that are to represent sapphires. And illegal sapphire mining in Madagascar is a habitat degradation issue that impacts lemurs. We have an artificial rosewood stump in there. And rosewood is illegally harvested and used for high-end furniture and guitar frets. Gibson was cited in 2012. For illegally sourced rosewood. So there's purchases that we can make here. We have a coffee tree that we bring out seasonally, and I'm growing a vanilla vine at home. And coffee and vanilla are both exports from Madagascar that people in Delaware can choose to purchase. So you need to make sure that purchases that you're making are legally sourced and benefit both the animals and the people in Madagascar. So we can say you're excited about lemurs and these cute animals, but here's ways that you can help them in the wild. So what actions can we give our guests to help the animals that they're excited about?
Mandy, how about you? As you think about connecting people to habitats and environments, what are your top priorities? Are there those maybe one or two really important guiding principles that you try to follow?
Absolutely. So our guiding principle is for everyone, when possible, to see, touch, feel, and apply what they've learned at the museum in their own backyard, their own community, and certainly on their big, beautiful planet that we have as they go about their travels. So we try to incorporate hands-on activities, whether that's a live animal demonstration, an actual backyard tour where we're looking for insects, we're studying fungi, we're monitoring the quality of soil and trees in our very own backyard. Every opportunity there is to bring nature to life and make it relatable is something that we relish.
So what you guys are talking largely about is visitor experience and this idea of, I guess, making it real for people, right, Mandy? Is that maybe kind of what we're talking about here, is that when people come in, they're not just kind of reading something, you know, a display, that there's something tangible for them to connect to?
That's part of it. The other part is delivering that content in a way that the user wants delivered. So we are mindful that not everyone wants to read a museum sign or join a pre-assigned group tour where we have a set of facts that we're going to discuss. So we're trying to incorporate more opportunities where we utilize QR codes so that people can delve more in depth into a specific topic that they're interested in, by making reference to books that are available in our bookstore, but also speakers in the field, trying to bring those into the museum so that they have those live interaction opportunities with experts. And one of the other opportunities we're exploring is the use of augmented reality and audio tours. We understand everyone learns differently, and so we're trying to be mindful of how that occurs.
Bryn, you talked a little bit specifically about the Madagascar segment of the zoo. What are some of the other things you're doing in terms of visitor experience to kind of bring home some of the things that you're trying to do and really make those connections for people?
Similar to what Mandy had said, we have a pollinator exhibit with a visible beehive. So people come up, see the bees, but then they can look through windows and see a pollinator garden behind it. So they can see the bees going out, sitting on the flowers. They make that connection between the animals and the plants. And then also in there, we have a number of things, including rain barrels and water stations for both birds and bees. So you see how you can make your backyard, whatever your backyard is, a yard, a deck, a porch, habitat for the animals. And we also have QR codes. Our pollinator garden has three different certifications from National Wildlife Federation and Pennsylvania Audubon, so that you can see that you can do these things at home. So get excited about the animals here and then go home. We do educational programs, but again, as Mandy said, not everybody's interested in a formal program. They want to come and experience it in their own way.
Certainly, you know, museums, zoos, all these type of places need to kind of change and grow and evolve over the years. And certainly that's true of both of your places. Can you talk a little bit about some of the changes that have been made in recent years and how you feel they've kind of helped enhance what you do and enhance the connections that you're making for people with their environment around them? Britt, we'll go with you first.
Sure. I think for a long time, people viewed zoos as consumers of wildlife. And that's a true statement. And that's no longer the case. The animals we have are managed appropriately for conservation within the zoo community. But we're also doing a lot of outreach. We are working with animals outside of our perimeter fence. We're supporting wildlife in Madagascar by supporting alley cropping and programs like that. We're working with Delaware Fish and Wildlife, and we're incubating endangered bog turtle eggs here. So right now we've hatched out more bog turtles at the zoo in the past 3 years than there are known adults in the wild. We've got 34 hatchlings from last year, and we're incubating 52 eggs that are supposed to start hatching next week. So we're working outside of our perimeter and starting to take that messaging out so that people understand, you know, we're not just a place with animals in cages. We're doing a lot more than what they see.
And Mandy, I know, you know, obviously the Delaware Museum of Nature and Science kind of did a big rebranding a couple of years ago. You know, what else is going on there in terms of this kind of evolution and change and development and growth of the museum?
Absolutely. Well, back in 2020, there was a significant investment in renovating our physical spaces, and they're absolutely beautiful. I think if anyone hasn't been to the museum, I highly encourage you to do so. But beyond that, we're looking, how do we bring the museum to life in other areas or for individuals that can't reach the museum? And one of the ways that we're delivering that is through the mobile museum program, where we literally bring the field trip to you, whether that's in your corporate office, your place of worship, a school or a daycare, even a library. We will come with live animals, live specimens, fossils from all around the world, and deliver that content and hands-on activity in the comfort of your own home, as so to say. The other opportunity that we're taking is really to engage our members and our visitors as to how they would like museum life to live beyond the walls of the museum. And one of the opportunities that we've taken is around workforce development. We appreciate that, especially teens who might age out of some of our museum exhibits at a certain point are looking for that next step. And so we do offer a teen science cafe that is literally designed by teens and aimed for teens in grades 7 through 12. It's an opportunity for them to network with industry leaders. It's an opportunity to socialize and really explore career paths that they may not have considered previously without exposure to visiting the museum and interacting with some of our staff. Breaking into STEAM, which is an annual event that we host, invites Delaware-based employers to encourage and have informational interviews with teens who are not necessarily thinking about their career in that moment, but providing that exposure, again, to different career paths they may not have considered, whether that's in banking or pharmaceuticals or even engineering. So we're looking beyond the walls of the museum to stay in touch, stay relevant, and again, reinforce some of our concepts.
I was going to say, what you're both talking a lot about here is the outreach and how important is that to the modern museum, to the modern zoo, especially when it comes to kids in schools, to making it truly vibrant and truly part of the community. Brent, we'll go with you.
It's critical. And, you know, we tell people that the Brandywine Zoo is a small facility and always will be, but we have the opportunity to be that first step into nature for a lot of kids. And so being located right in the middle of Wilmington, we're such an urban facility that we have that opportunity. And you look at the exotic animals we have, and one of the things that I'm always impressed and amused with is that our goats are probably one of the most important animals that we have here, because, you know, kids don't have an opportunity to interact with animals the way children did in earlier years. So that opportunity to go in and touch a goat is something that's really special for them, and they get excited, and then they get excited about other animals. So we try and make that connection as much as possible with our living collection.
Mandy, how about you in terms of outreach, and how important is that youth outreach to kids in schools to really making the museum a vibrant place?
It's critical to our work, and it's one of the founding principles of our strategic plan, particularly serving underserved communities. And so we invest quite a bit in providing free or discounted tickets, school field trips, programming tours, but also incorporating some of that virtual education and, again, delivering our on-site content to them. So it's significant to what we do. We're, again, exploring with how we can incorporate technology and virtual programming, even at some point, hopefully launching an online university, if you will, a mini university anyway, so that folks can explore on their own time at their own convenience, and understanding that we're broader than just serving the Wilmington or Newcastle County community. We serve the entire state of Delaware. And so making sure that we have the opportunity to reach audiences in Kent and Sussex County is important to us as well, and something that we're working on.
You mentioned the technology piece, and I'll ask both of you this, how big of a game changer is technology to what you do, whether it's something as simple, maybe it's a QR code, to some of the other things you guys have mentioned, the virtual things, the augmented reality type of things. How big of a game changer is modern technology to what you do? Well, Mandy, you can kind of continue on that thought.
I wouldn't say that it's a game changer anymore. I think it is now the standard. People are interested in utilizing technology, not necessarily moving away from it. And to be honest, it's something that I've spent a good portion of my career trying to do, get kids and adults away from their devices and out in nature. But I feel like I've lost that battle. So now I need to regroup and figure out how I can use that to my own advantage and still provide that educational content in a fun and interactive way, but still utilizing either apps or software, or even moving into the hologram augmented reality world. So I think that's coming soon for us, even though I have mixed feelings about it.
Brent, how about you? I mean, how do you feel about this kind of marriage of technology and what you do, and both, you know, maybe the potential and possible pitfalls?
I'm right there with you, Mandy. You know, I always enjoy when kids come to the zoo and they're not on a screen. You know, here's the real animal. And there was always a thought when nature programs started up on TV that these would be able to replace zoos. And with a television program, you're seeing what the producer wants you to see. But when you come to the zoo, it's real life, and you see and hear and smell, and you get that full experience. One of the things that we're looking forward to, we have a working on a new exhibit at the entrance, which will be flamingos, and looking forward to the opportunity to have people be able to feed a flamingo. So you see, hear, feel that bird filter feeding right in your hand. Having said that, though, you know, we are moving into that technology realm. We're using more QR codes for a lot of our programming. And during COVID, we switched our education programs completely so that we were doing virtual programming, just to keep in touch with children, to, you know, keep them engaged and keep them thinking about the zoo and nature.
So I have to ask you about the challenges of this work, and specifically the economic challenges. How difficult is kind of the economics of doing this to delivering on your mission, Mandy? The economics only get more and more challenging.
Unfortunately. Yes, I think running a nonprofit in general is challenging, but particularly in today's climate where, in our own experience, we've had grants that were rescinded or grant proposals that were probably funded, but we still haven't received the funding, makes it extremely difficult to plan your cash flow and your business operations and pay bills and make payroll. But we do it, and we are able to do that in part by, one, our admission fees, which I know can be a bit of a grumble for folks, particularly as prices are escalating everywhere else, but they really are a tremendous resource in helping us maintain not just the facility, but delivering some of these programs and educational opportunities. And why annual giving and supporting your local museum is so important. Because without you, we really can't do this. Yes, we apply for corporate and foundation support, but I think as most nonprofits can attest, they too are responding to their own operating budgets and the increased demand for assistance, as all of us are trying to figure out how do we cover one bill to the next. So very similar to everyone in their probably own individual households, we're trying to figure out where we can scale back and be cost efficient, but we always, always need the support of the community. That's our biggest investment, and we appreciate it.
Bern, how about on your end at the zoo? How challenging is the economics of all this now?
A little bit different than Mandy is, since we're a state-run organization. We have the support of the Delaware state government. Biggest time that showed up for us was during COVID, and we were closed for a while like everybody else. Once things started opening up, people wanted to be outside. So our attendance was down, but people were starting to come back. But the state park campgrounds were full. So we were able to weather that storm with the support of the state. The Delaware Zoological Society is our nonprofit entity, and they're responsible for our operations and concessions, and they fund our conservation mission. So it's important. Our events are important. Their fundraising is important so that we can keep doing the work that we're doing outside of our facility. The state is responsible for operating the zoo, and the society is responsible for supporting the development and future of the zoo. So those two partners work together to help make everything happen for us.
So I'm curious, how do you guys gauge success? And I guess maybe more specifically, what are you looking for people to walk away with when they complete a visit to either the zoo or the museum? Mandy, we'll start with you.
Obviously, for us, we're driven by attendance or visitation, but really, our goal is to make sure that everyone leaves here learning at least one new thing. And again, taking some of that information that they've learned by being able to see, touch, and feel some of the specimens and applying that in their own backyard. The word of mouth advertising also helps. So for us, that's a huge success when we hear that someone was recommended to us by a neighbor or a friend or even a fellow classmate. So we are extremely grateful that everyone who leaves here learns something, applies it, and then shares that. Really amplifies our message.
Bert, how about you?
We measure success in a number of different ways. Our society looks at attendance and revenue as their measures. Our education department looks at number of programming, and we do evaluations of all of our programming. So, are people enjoying, are people learning from the programs? And then the animal department looks at our husbandry and in some cases reproductive success. So the bog turtles that we hatch out, the baby crown lemur that we had born this year, there's only 40 crown lemurs in the country, and we have 10% of the U.S. population here in Delaware. So that's a significant investment and success for an endangered species. So we look at it in a lot of different ways. And fortunately, all the metrics are trending up for us.
Are there some specific things you guys look at when you think about specifically connecting to Delaware and helping people understand the environment and habitats here in Delaware itself? Britt, I think you mentioned a couple of things. Are there some other things that you are really focused on when you're talking about Delaware and its habitats and environment to the people who visit?
Sure. The things we do on grounds, like I said, primarily birds and butterflies and pollinators are things that people get to see. The bog turtles are a conservation message that we're a little bit more guarded with just because the rarity of the animals. We're also working with Fish and Wildlife, and there's a population of copperheads in Alapocas Park. So last year we went out and collected 10 copperheads and put transponders in them, and Fish and Wildlife is able to track those animals through the park. And so we're getting some information on what they're lifestyle and habits are like, so we know where they move, where they hibernate, and we're gaining valuable information on that. And this year we started with some transponder work with Fish and Wildlife on tiger salamanders. So again, another species that we're working, you know, here in Delaware to learn more about.
Mandy, how about you? Looking kind of specifically at connecting people with Delaware and its environment and habitats, are there some things you guys are specifically working on?
I don't think you can connect any more directly with Delaware than our floor map in the Regional Journey Gallery. It literally represents the diverse ecosystems from every aspect of the state, so you can find where you are on that map. And practicing simple things, lifting a horseshoe crab, not a live one, of course, but finding a tree frog or mosquito fish, learning about poison dart frogs. We literally have something for everyone when it comes to what types of plants, trees, animals are native and how you can help support their habitats, again, in your own backyard. So I don't think we make it any more relatable. I encourage you to come here and experience it for yourself.
This podcast is kind of all about, you know, connecting people with the planet around them. And I guess, you know, I'll start with you, Mandy. You know, how do you wrap your head around that concept and the importance of it in this day and age, in a time of climate change and other pressures on the environment? Is it hard sometimes for you to wrap your head around it and also help other people wrap their head around, you know, the importance of the mission that you guys are trying to fulfill?
I don't know that it's hard. I think it just requires frequent reminders. So whether that's planting native trees, whether that's recycling, whether that's being mindful of your electricity and utility use, there are simple things people can do every day to help protect the planet and simple things they can do in their own community to help improve habitat for wildlife. So whether that's building a bluebird box, whether that's planting pollinator-friendly shrubs and flowers, everyone can play a role. It's not expensive, it's relatable, it's possible, and it's doable. And we amplify our success when every single person takes responsibility and ownership for it. So we appreciate those who do, we appreciate those who are trying, and we appreciate those who are brand new and willing to learn and assist.
Brett, how about you picking up on that?
Yeah, and I agree with all of that. And the other thing that we're trying to do is meet people in their spaces. And that's come up a couple times in this conversation. So, you know, how do we get people in and, you know, once they're here, get them excited? So different events like being open late in the evening, sip and strolls, brew at the zoo, will bring people in and then we can reach our message that way. And then it's also the partnerships that we form. And some of them are kind of unusual. One of our staff members was at a restaurant and conversation came up on birds and window strikes. So we're now having conversations with this restaurant on ways that we can help them protect their glass, protect the birds. And it was something that they hadn't thought about. And as that conversation unfolds, we start with window strikes. We talk about pollinator plants around the restaurant. We talk about bird-friendly coffee. And then suddenly you've reached a whole group of people that wouldn't have necessarily had exposure to what we're preaching at the zoo. So it's taking that message and amplifying it as much as we can in different directions.
I agree with wholeheartedly. And one of the opportunities we're trying to pursue here at the museum is around sound bathing, the concept of being in nature, enjoying those sights and sounds, and using that as a stress-relieving, anxiety-relieving, blood pressure-reducing technique, similar to meditation. But for those of us like myself, whose brain never shuts off, I need a little more assistance with that. So bringing in instructors who can help utilize the beautiful grounds that we have, but help people appreciate and relax in nature.
You've been listening to a portion of the Delaware Humanities podcast, People and Planet, with Mandy Santiago, Executive Director of the Delaware Museum of Nature and Science, and Brent Spencer, Brandywine Zoo Director. The full podcast is available at DelawarePublic.org and DEHumanities.org. People and Planet is brought to you by Delaware Humanities, a state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in this program do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. And that's a wrap on this edition of The Green. The stories, interviews, and podcasts you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website.
You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter there by clicking newsletters at the top of the page. And Remember the Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page or by emailing us at thegreen@delawarepublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make this week's show possible, the staff at Delaware Humanities, and Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny and Sarah Petrowich. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Byrne saying thanks for joining us this week, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into A First State of Mind.